Okay, so this is the beginning of an 8-week fundamental teachings class. And let's see. Tonight we're studying anicca, which is impermanence, anatta, which is not self, and the five skandhas, which I will talk about. And I have handouts for those in the Dirt Sendo. You can pass those around. And then for those in the cloud, I can share, have a little document that I don't know. I think what I'll do is give you a link to it, so if you choose to, you can open it up and refer to it. But if you don't want it taking up part of your screen, you don't have to. Let's see. Sorry, I meant to have this done ahead of time, but I never do. Okay, I will put this in the chat.
It'll be in the chat and we just click on it.
Yes. And it goes to a Google Doc, and I know sometimes people have trouble opening those. So let me know if there's anybody who wants that and needs me to share screen instead. I think if I share screen, I think you can always opt out of, like, on your own device, you can say, I don't want to see that anymore. So, anybody, go ahead and raise your hand if you need me to share my screen, or whether you can get that. And it's not absolutely necessary. It's just I'm using some funny words, and sometimes it's easier to see that. All right. So, as we study these teachings, and the way that I've laid them out for this particular class series is they really, these eight basic fundamental teaching classes, they really build on each other. So recently, in my guided practice groups, we've been talking about Buddha nature and emptiness. And sometimes people are just like, ah, yeah. And I realized, like, that's kind of like jumping into the, I don't know, jumping into the deep end of the pool, when it's like, all of these teachings build on each other, and that I realized it might be a more accessible way to really start at the beginning and, go to these more and more kind of subtle concepts. So that's what we'll be doing over the course of these 8 weeks. So starting at the very beginning, I just want to say that this is not, in terms of how I recommend that you engage these teachings, is to remember that this is not philosophy. It's not metaphysical speculation. So tonight we're going to talk about, like, the three marks of existence. And the Buddha said, all things are impermanent, all things are not self. And so we can start to, kind of, and it's fine to kind of grasp it intellectually and wrestle with it, but it's not about the Buddha saying, I'm telling you how the world is out there, right? It's not him saying, like, it's not atomic theory or something like that. All of it has to do, every single thing. The Buddha said this repeatedly. His only purpose was to relieve suffering. His only purpose, and any of the teachings are simply about human beings relieving their own suffering and distress. So it's all from that perspective. So anything that he's saying about the world is all directly related to that. So next week we're going to talk about dukkha and the Four Noble Truths. And dukkha is one of the three characteristics of existence or three marks. So we're going to mention it tonight, but not go into great detail about it because it deserves its own thing. But so just briefly though, so dukkha is often translated as suffering. So all of these are ancient terms which have many different translations. So dukkha is often translated as suffering. So you hear that the Buddha's teaching is that life is marked by suffering. And sometimes you may go, yeah, I relate to that. And sometimes you may be like, well, that sounds kind of negative. It's not always marked by suffering. So dukkha, and so sometimes it's helpful to even just use these terms instead of the translations. But dukkha can be translated as dissatisfactoriness, unease, dis-ease, stress, uncomfortableness, or suffering. And many of you have heard me tell this story before, but I found this wonderful description of the etymology of dukkha, a Pali or Sanskrit word. So su and du are prefixes indicating good or bad. So su, my dog's name is Sukha, which means happiness or bliss. And dukkha is, dis-ease and all that. So su and du. And ka, in later Sanskrit, meaning sky, ether, or space, was originally the word for hole, particularly an axle hole in one of the Aryan's vehicles. So dukkha means having a bad axle hole. So if you're riding in a carriage and you're like, I mean, so it's like that's kind of what the comment about life, I mean, sometimes it's suffering, but it's not ever permanently comfortable. So it can be stressful, and that's the comment. The main comment on the nature of life. So basically the three marks of existence, the three characteristics of existence are explaining why is life like this? So this is from the Dhammapada, and I've given you the quote on this little slip and on the shared document. So the Buddha says, all conditioned things are anicca. That is impermanent or inconstant. When one sees this with wisdom, one turns away from suffering. This is the path to purification. All conditioned things are dukkha, unsatisfying, uneasy, uncomfortable suffering. When one sees this with wisdom, one turns away from suffering. This is the path to purification. All things are anatta, not self or non-substantial. When one sees this with wisdom, one turns away from suffering. This is the path to purification. And then on also included on the slip or on the shared document, in another sutta, the Buddha explains how these three are related. He says, the body is impermanent. What is impermanent, that is suffering or dukkha. What is dukkha, that is not self. What is not self should be considered as, this is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. In this manner, it should be seen according to actuality with perfect wisdom. And then in the original sutta, the Buddha continues that same, makes that same statement with regard to feelings, perceptions, mental activities or formations, and consciousness. So that's on the back of our little sheet here, or further down on the document. Those are the five skandhas or aggregates. And they're meant to be the summation of everything that we are. So everything you can think of that you might identify as self or as part of your experience falls into one of those categories. So generally, it's a quite if you do much reading of these older suttas, you'll notice there's often, and actually, yeah, we listed in the Heart Sutra as well, form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness. So form being the body and all of its physical processes and manifestations, sensations, there's the six sense organs. In Buddhism, it's the mind is considered a sense organ that senses thoughts. So there's the organs and their what they sense: sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and sensing of thoughts. Perception, the mind's perception of whatever is sensed. So there's, if there was just light coming in our eyes and there are no brain to perceive it and make sense of it, it wouldn't go any further. Then mental formations or conceptual fabrications are all the mental activity beyond that basic perception. And then consciousness is that higher order awareness of objects and processes, including self-consciousness. So, these teachings are meant to be deeply and personally contemplated, if you will, experientially explored. Many of us can go, yeah, life is impermanent. But it's like we're meant to really realize and actually realize, like, this person is impermanent. Everything that I care about, that I depend on, that makes sense of my world is also impermanent. So I thought I'd share this little sutta, which I think makes it quite gritty. So this is the Loka Sutta called The World. And then a certain monk went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, the world, it is said. In what respect does the word world apply? And the Buddha responds, in so far as it disintegrates, it is called the world. Now, what disintegrates? The I disintegrates. Forms disintegrate. Consciousness at the I disintegrates. Contact at the I disintegrates. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, contact between the eye and whatever it might perceive, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too disintegrates. The ear disintegrates, sounds disintegrate, and so on, right? You go through the whole, you can see, like, these suttas were transmitted orally for hundreds of years before being written down. So they're really kind of meant to be read aloud, right? Sounds disintegrate. Consciousness at the ear disintegrates. Contact at the ear disintegrates. So the nose disintegrates. Aromas disintegrate. The tongue disintegrates. Tastes disintegrate. The body disintegrates. Tactile sensations disintegrate. The intellect disintegrates, ideas disintegrate. Consciousness at the intellect consciousness disintegrates. Contact at the intellect disintegrates. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too disintegrates. Insofar as it disintegrates, it is called the world. So, if you will, This is about like kind of a deep kind of existential angst. What are we? What can we depend on? So, what can we do about this? I mean, what the Buddha would not be pointing this out if it within it didn't hold the key to something that we could do to relieve our suffering. So I'm going to read part of this sutta, and then I'm just going to open it up to questions and comments. So this is the Nakula Pita Sutta. And this old man comes to ask the Buddha or the Blessed One some questions. And he says he's advanced in years and having come to the last stage of life, afflicted in body and ailing with every movement. And it's rare, so he wants to get a teaching. And so the Buddha says, okay, so your body is afflicted, weak, and encumbered. You should train yourself. Even though I may be afflicted in body, my mind will be unafflicted. That is how you should train yourself. So the householder Nakula Pita was thrilled having gotten a teaching from the Buddha. And then he went off and he told one of the Buddha's disciples, Shariputra, about like, it's this great, I just got this teaching from the Buddha. And the Shariputra said, did you ask him what he meant? The guy's like, well, I can ask you. So Shariputra then explains. So what does it mean to be afflicted in body but unafflicted in mind? So first of all, Shariputra starts off by saying, first, how is one afflicted in body and afflicted in mind? So he says there is the case where an uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person who has no regard for the noble ones, who is not well versed or disciplined in their dhamma or the teaching or practice, who has no regard for men of integrity, is not well versed or disciplined in their dhamma, assumes the form, the body, to be the self, or the self as possessing form, or form as in the self, or the self as in form. He is seized with the idea that I am form, or form is mine. As he is seized with these ideas, his form changes and alters, and he falls into sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair over its change and alteration. He assumes feeling to be the self. So now we're going to go through body form, since feelings. Sensations, so sensations, feelings are that very initial interaction between object and sense. And then perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. So he assumes feeling to be the self, or the self is possessing feeling, or feeling is in the self, or the self is in feeling, or I am feeling, or feeling is mine. And then when this changes, he is. Or she, it falls into sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair over its change and alteration. She assumes perception to be the self. And when you really list all of these things, even if you think of yourself as being fairly wise and detached or something, one of these is going to be like, yeah, I guess I kind of think of it that way. I have that. I'm in that. So mental fabrications to be the self, or the self is possessing mental fabrications, or mental fabrications as in the self, or the self is in mental fabrications. Same with consciousness. And this householder is how one is afflicted in body and afflicted in mind. And how is one afflicted in body but unafflicted in mind? There is the case where a well-instructed disciple of the noble ones, who has regard for the noble ones, is well-versed and disciplined in their dhamma, does not assume form to be the self, or the self as possessing form, or form as in the self, or the self as in form. He is not seized by the idea that I am form or form is mine. As he is not seized with these ideas, his form changes and alters, but he does not fall into sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, or despair over its change and alteration. And we do not assume feeling to be the self, do not assume perception to be the self, mental fabrications to be the self, or even consciousness to be the self, or the self is possessing consciousness. This householder is how one is afflicted in body but unafflicted in mind. So the practice is very simple and not simple. And you know, the next week we'll talk about dukkha and the Four Noble Truths. And the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, which is the third week. And that's the how. It's kind of, it's all well and good to just tell us not to do that. But there is a how. How do we work on ourselves? How do we work on our minds so that we can refrain from that kind of identification? Well, the point here is that if we simply do not identify all of this stuff as self, then we are relieved of that kind of distress. When we see things change, we cannot grasp them. They are unsubstantial. So I will open it up for some thoughts or questions. Yeah.
Question about that. It's can you explain the difference between the mental formation and consciousness?
So Kate asked the difference between mental formations and consciousness in terms of the skandhas. To be honest, I think this is probably like a really kind of philosophical. I mean, the Indians were just, you know, amazing of these different lists and parsing out experience and stuff like that. I'm kind of not 100%, but I don't know. I guess the way that I think about it is, you know, there's all kinds of activity in my mind, which in some senses I'm not even in control of, right? Just thoughts and just thoughts going through my mind and processes and whatever. And I'm not they may or may not be delivered or not. They're the content. But then consciousness is kind of a meta-awareness of, I don't know, of myself, of like of a theme. Yeah, almost like a narrative theme tying it together. And I think self-consciousness is the most important aspect of this. A sense of myself over time that I can tie all those mental experiences and sensations and perceptions and think of myself. Coral.
Okay. Trying to think of a way to word my question. So I have a lot of questions, but I'll choose one. So I'm really, if you were to say like you're just the self, your personality or the self, it's just a result of the karma. I don't know if that's what you would say, but I would be like, okay, fine, that's fine. It's not real. I'm fine with that. I accept that. But I'm really struggling on the experiential part of that. And so I guess that falls into the category like, okay, well, maybe I should study the self. And am I in studying the self, am I studying myself the way that I'm identifying in the skandhas? Like am I looking for those contact points and these issues with these, or maybe not, maybe they're not negative, but my identification with the Skandhas.
I'm not sure
Okay.
exactly what you're saying.
Is studying the Skandhas and how you relate to them studying the self?
But that's, yeah, it's part of it. I mean, when we in Zen, when we talk about it, I think we're also talking about kind of learning our karmic patterns, and there's a bigger context to the way that we talk about studying the self, but kind of ultimately in the sense of awakening, we are, I mean, the traditional practice is really to examine closely body, feelings, perceptions, and to see, essentially, to see their impermanence and insubstantiality. And once we see that, we recognize there can't be a self in it. Like, oh, this is a great, so this is from Tenisiro Bhikkhu's The Five Aggregates, a Study Guide. And he explains how clinging to the skandhas leads to suffering. The sense of me and mine we get from identifying with or claiming possession of one of these things. And he says the skanda is rarely stat or the skanda and our identification with it is rarely static. It roams like an amoeba, changing its contours as it changes location, sometimes expansive, sometimes contracted. It can view itself as identical with a skanda, as possessing a skanda, as existing within a skanda, or having a skanda existing within itself. At times feeling finite, at other times infinite. Whatever shape it takes, it's always unstable and insecure. For the skandhas providing its food are simply activities and functions, inconstant and insubstantial. In the words of the canon, the skandhas are like foam, like a mirage, like bubbles formed when rain falls on water. They're heavy only because of the iron grip of trying to cling to them. Only because the iron grip of trying to cling to them is burdensome. As long as we're addicted to passion and delight for these activities, as long as we cling to them, we are bound to suffer. So you were saying, like, you're studying your attachment to them?
I assume that the skandhas and realizing that the skandhas are the things that describe you is, or describe you the self, is normal. Like, that's not a good or bad. It's just a way to describe it. But as soon as you start identifying yourself as form or identifying yourself as consciousness, that's when that leads to suffering because it's impermanent and it's not real. So when I'm trying to like study the self and I see these skandhas, I don't know, my question is unraveling now in my mind.
I mean, you see them. Can we see them without identifying with them? And this is really subtle. I mean, one of my biggest examples of this, I mean, there's many examples, I'm sure, but like, in practicing mindfulness, I realized I got very attached to a certain kind of consciousness. Like, when I wanted to be mindful, I wanted to be present and conscious of being present, self-aware. Like, I am now appreciative of my life. I am now washing the dishes. I am now driving the car. I am like, that's what I think of as myself. I am here. When I am aware of me. I am here. That's me. And then I would say things like, and then my mind would wander and I'm not even there. And then I come back. I really, I, And that's and then it's distressing, right? Then it feels like I'm only present for like 5% of my life because I can only manage to be mindful, and then my mind wanders and I'm not there. So it's like you're causing suffering by being identified with and attached to that particular kind of consciousness, when in fact consciousness comes and goes. So as we know, our bodies change. Another aspect of this, which I see Rachel and Candy and John, I'll take those questions before I go on to my next favorite sutta. Go ahead, Rachel.
It's not much of a question as it's mostly how I think you're trying to explain it as like, but I'm not exactly sure. So I'm just going to toss out my example and see if it hits something. Who knows? Just getting on the wall. How I see it is it's similar to like a dissociative incident. Yourself is the body, and all of a sudden your consciousness goes out. And you see yourself, you know you're doing something, you hear yourself talking, you're not in control of it. And that is one way of like being a sukha or impermanence and things like that. Your body's doing your one thing, consciousness is not even there. And then when your consciousness comes back, it hits you really hard, and all of a sudden you're awake. And it's like, oh, I did these things. I said that, or did I say that? Who said what? And it's always that question of who? Who's the self? Who is there a who in this? Is my mind the who? Is my body the who? Is my voice the who? So you always have to keep asking those questions, I think. That's just how I saw it.
It is maddening to explore this stuff intellectually.
Yes.
I mean, there's part of me that's just kind of like, I don't know what it does not make sense anymore. But it's really like, it's really, this is just a tool for practice, right? Just a tool for studying the way that we cause our own suffering. And this idea of just refraining from, identifying with the skandhas, or thinking that that's, the skandha's mine, or I'm within the skandha, or whatever. I mean, who of us is not to some extent identified with our consciousness, for God's sake? I mean, like, what am I? If I'm not conscious, who am I? But it's more of recognizing that this is insubstantial and impermanent, and I cannot grasp it, right? This unfolding self is a mystery. It doesn't mean that we don't exist and we don't have a power of choice. But if we're trying to grasp at any one of those skandhas, we will end up feeling dukkha. Candy.
Actually, you just said what I was thinking, because I just was feeling like, is it I feel like it's okay to identify. In fact, I think it's necessary to identify with all these portions of ourself, but to just realize how insubstantial, how impermanent it is, how fluid it is, how, because even like I feel like you said, it causes suffering. Even the idea that my consciousness is me. Well, I know that if I live long enough, I'm probably going to get dementia. Am I no longer me? Do I no longer exist? And I feel like that's not okay. I feel like to have that kind of that level of like, I must be like, I don't know, there's no eternal, there's, and I think it's hard because especially coming from like a Judeo-Christian background where people are always seeking for eternal life. People are always looking for that eternity, that place of permanence. And so learning to know that there is eternity, but it's not that it's not static, that it's fluid and changing is is kind of some is somewhat difficult to get, but then I think also it's freeing and liberating because it kind of feels like, oh, okay, it's all right. Because my like when you're saying like, oh, I'm not present. Well, my body was here the whole time, so I've taught some classes with some kids who are like, I was present in class. You better not count me as absent. So I just feel like it's this taking all of that for what it's worth. Just you know, I mean, and I and like you, and I think it's nice to kind of give ourselves a break of that. The consciousness doesn't have to constantly be here all the time. I feel like trying to make that happen is really exhausting and hard, and like you said, causes suffering. That's just my personal thing. So I just feel liberated and gratified by this today. Thank you so very much.
And this is very, I mean, this is very, at first it sounds very kind of philosophical, but it's very practical also. Like another example that I'm experienced and was so grateful for is in just a, I had huge sensitivity to criticism. And somebody would say something critical and just be like, oh, I'm just such a shitty person. And just like, and there's like, there's no one who is shitty, right? It's like, I may have some unskillful things, some skillful habits. I may have some limitations. That's not excusing them. It's not trying to stay that way. It's just like, no. That's just part of it's part of my pile, right? Here's my pile, my aggregates, and sometimes it doesn't come off very well, but there's no I don't have to identify with any part of that. I can just and let it go. John.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep.
First, thank you for this talk. You know, you covered it in many podcasts, and I've listened to it many other times, but you always seem to keep it really fresh. So thank you. So the not self, I can grasp it intellectually. And I try not to hold stuff too lightly. I mean, I'm not totally convinced, but I just hold all those things lightly. And you know, if I fake it till I make it in that way, it almost seems kind of spiritual bypassing in a way, when you're saying, oh, well, that's not me or whatever. But I do find it very helpful when I'm not as connected, when I'm holding it lightly. So I'm kind of torn between the whole spiritual bypassing and holding it lightly and whatnot. And I know that you're going to say the answer is Zazen and everything else, but I'm not sure how to end up knowing it, right? Not intellectually, but really seeing it. And so I was wondering if you could, you know, walk us through the letting go. How do you get out of the intellectual, and basically see this impermanence and not self? And then, you know, if you do, how do you know that that's real and not this, right? I mean, because the relative part is an aspect of reality, this whole relative stuff. So, you know, how do you say one is more correct than the other? How do you know that? How do you get convinced? So.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, like all of the teachings can be used incorrectly for like spiritual bypassing stuff, right? You could totally say, ah, not self, but the Buddha would say that's actually just another view of self. That's saying I'm the self over here and I'm not that crap over there. So he made it clear, like basically what we're trying to work toward is letting go of our obsession with self. Everything else remains, right? We have to take care of our lives. These are our aggregates. But this obsession with self, which I just love this, all kinds of concerns that preoccupy unenlightened human beings. And this is attending inappropriately. This is basically, if you want to exacerbate your suffering, keep thinking like this. And if you want to have liberation and peace, then there's other things you should think about, like which is elaborated in practice and in the Eightfold Path. It says, this is how she attends inappropriately. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Or he is inwardly perplexed about the immediate presence. Present. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where is it bound? And then six kinds of views arise. The view I have a self, the view I have no self, the view that it is precisely by means of a self that I perceive self, or the view that it is precisely by means of self I perceive not self, or the view it is precisely by means of not self that I perceive self. Or this very self of mine, the knower that is sensitive here and now to the ripening of good and bad actions, is the self of mine that is constant, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and will stay just as it is for eternity. This is called a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion of views, a writhing of views, a fetter of views. Bound by a fetter of views, the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person is not freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair. No matter how you might think of it, so the Buddha did not say there is no self. So, and really, he did not say, like, oh, there's that pile of skandhas, there's no self there. Just don't identify and cling. It's a subtle kind of thing, right? It's not a statement about whether there is a self or not. It is about how we use our own minds, how we relate to our experience. And the whole idea of this I, me, and my making, which is the way that it's phrased in the early teachings, is just completely unnecessary. We think it is, the bedrock of our existence to understand I, me, and mine. But in fact, it's not necessary. But we have to study the self in order to realize that, right? So we have to turn within and recognize the ways in which we are over-identifying or telling these stories or becoming obsessed. Other. And really, it's practical in the sense that, it's like, okay, well, when you go home and contemplate these things, do you sit on the zazen cushion? And I mean, you do. Like, actually, it can be very potent to sit zazen and ask who sits here? But with a very open-ended, with your mind very open, right? Instead of who sits here, and you're trying to come up with a million answers, like, well, I'm so and so. Here's my name. Da da da. But kind of letting go with this open question, who? Because as we examine each of these things, we recognize that it's insubstantial and impermanent. And as another sutta, which explains. Going through the skandhas again, if the body constituted a self, then it would not give us trouble. And it would be possible to manipulate the body by making determinations such as, let my body be this way, let my body not be that way. So, because the body does not constitute a self, it does give us trouble. And it is not possible to manipulate the body by making determinations such as, let my body be this way, let my body not be that way. And so, this is a similar kind of thing which we can realize in the course of our experience, right? We sit zazen and our minds are full of thoughts. Our thoughts are not a self, then. I mean, And it also begs the question, like, what are we really looking for? What do we really want in this self nature? We think we're clear on that, but we're not. It's kind of a moving target, like Denise or Obiku says. We just want a sense of, permanence, a sense of importance, a sense of something we can rely on. So feelings, we cannot just say, let my feelings be this way. Let my perceptions be this way. Let my mental fabrications be that way. Let my consciousness be that way. So when we practice, you see thoroughly, this is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. And as a big example, say you have something happens which is distressing, right? You lose a job, you lose a relationship, you lose your health, right? One of these things that you identify with is changing, despite the fact, in a way that you don't like, and despite the fact that you would like would rather it not. And can we say that is not me? That job, that status, that relationship, that way of being, that way of thinking, if we're starting to lose our mind, that is not me. Now we all want to go then, well, because I am, and then we want to find something else to identify as me. But just saying, just that is not me, that is also not me. Natalie.
So this is related. Maybe it's a little off, but related. And this is something I was thinking on the Zazen mat today of just the big question of, okay, if we're not identifying with self and with form, and there's just really a oneness, why did the oneness split into all these forms? Why? That's what was going through my head, which it's related, but why all these forms and bodies and thoughts then?
I mean,
Why?
that is an amazing question. Len says, because it's fun. I think, well, for one thing, the Buddha would say that's a question that does not tend to edification. That is a question that is, you can think about that all your life, and like, it's not necessarily going to lead to any kind of peace of mind or satisfaction or anything like that. And it's not necessary. Like, peace of mind and satisfaction can be reached without ever knowing the answer to that question. And it's probably unanswerable.
I spent too long thinking about this one.
But I mean, I've thought about it.
I
thought
know,
about it. Why?
What if we're trying to
Why
get
is it
back?
so hard? But it's like, I guess if you think of it kind of like, okay, there's you look at an innocent little child, and they don't have a as much anyway of a sense of separation as we do, or you might look at an animal or something like that, right? And yet we want to raise our children so that they grow and they mature and they individuate, which also causes a lot of problems. But then when they can come like back around to a sense of oneness and connection, that's a beautiful thing unto itself, which if none of us ever, individuated, there wouldn't be that coming back together. I don't know, like I would have heard some, God made things so that he could be known, or that,
To
we could
understand
So that
itself.
we could know ourselves,
Yeah.
or something
Right,
like that. It's
something of
almost
that.
like, I mean, because life is things coming about in individual forms.
So the oneness understanding itself by differentiating and then coming back.
And then, I mean, because there would be no life. So we say, without sentient beings, there are no Buddhas. So without beings who perceive themselves as separate and need to find their way back, there would be no Buddhas who awaken.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like individuation is a curse, but then it also can be a blessing when we transcend it.
Thank you.
That's very good question. All
Yeah.
right, it's 9:01, so I should wrap it up. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Mahaprajna Paramita. Right. Thank you all for coming.
Good
Thanks,
night.
everyone. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Have a good night.